From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Washington voices support for Seoul's outreach to Pyongyang. The possibility of new activity at a North Korean nuclear research center. As ground shifts, Obama reviews Middle East strategy. And terrorism finds roots in failed states.
The dichotomy that's set up is often between opportunity versus grievance.
I'm Susan Yawkey. Two U.S. diplomatic envoys are in Northeast Asia this week to consult with allies on stalled negotiations with North Korea about its nuclear weapons program. VOA's Brian Padden in Seoul reports Washington has been bolstering regional support for maintaining sanctions on North Korea, even as it expresses support for Seoul's recent unconditional offer to meet with Pyongyang.
After meeting with officials in Seoul, Wendy Sherman, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, said there is no disagreement between the United States and South Korea over how to deal with North Korea.
We have the same policy as the Republic of Korea does, and that is to ultimately have a denuclearized peninsula. Denuclearization is the first priority where North Korea is concerned. And then, of course, we look forward to ending the division for the Korean people to be in a unified country under democratic rule.
North Korea, South Korea, Japan, China, Russia, and the United States began talks in 2003 with the aim of ridding the Korean Peninsula of nuclear weapons. But they were suspended after Pyongyang launched a ballistic missile. The United States and South Korea have been emphasizing different approaches to restart the process. In December, Seoul proposed talks with North Korea without preconditions to organize reunions for families that were separated by the division of the country at the end of World War II. Pyongyang rejected the offer, saying that Seoul must first lift economic sanctions before any talks could resume. The United States wants North Korea to first take credible action to curb its nuclear program before restarting talks. Washington imposed new sanctions against Pyongyang in the wake of the alleged North Korean cyber attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment. South Korean Special Representative for Korean Peninsular Peace and Security Affairs, Hwang Jun-kook, met for talks with U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Policy, Sung Kim, and Japanese officials in Tokyo. He says the U.S. government is actively supporting South-North dialogue. He says putting pressure on Pyongyang for its wrong behavior and keeping the doors of dialogue open for important issues such as the nuclear program are two separate approaches. Japan reduced sanctions against North Korea in July after the two sides agreed to reopen an investigation into the status of Japanese citizens kidnapped by Pyongyang decades ago. Undersecretary of State Sherman also met with officials in Beijing this week and says China continues to play an important leadership role in trying to persuade Pyongyang to give up its nuclear program. In violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions, Pyongyang has staged a number of nuclear tests and short ballistic missile launches and has launched a small satellite into space. South Korea's defense ministry said Thursday it could not confirm reports that North Korea has restarted a nuclear bomb fuel reactor in Yongbyon after a five-month shutdown. Kim Young-hyun, a professor of North Korean studies at Dongguk University in Seoul, says Pyongyang may be restarting activity there as a ploy to gain concessions from the West. He says North Korea is using a card, such as the restart of the nuclear reactor in Yongbyon, and is also strongly expressing that it will continue to work on its nuclear program to strengthen its determination. Professor Andrei Lankov, a North Korean analyst with Kookmin University in Seoul, says Pyongyang is unlikely to conduct any new nuclear tests for fear of alienating China, its key provider of economic assistance.
If they do nuclear tests, they might get themselves into a more serious trouble with China. And this is not what they want.
With joint U.S.-South Korea military drills scheduled in the coming months, tensions in the region will likely remain high. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
As our correspondent mentioned, recent commercial satellite imagery has detected new activity at the 5-megawatt plutonium production reactor at North Korea's Yongbyon Nuclear Research Center. The assessment, published on the 38 North website of the U.S. Korea Institute at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, says the North may be trying to restart the reactor after a nearly five-month pause, but says it's too early to reach a definitive conclusion. The imagery was taken between December 24th and January 11th and shows steam from a probable pressure relief valve on a steam pipe before it enters the turbine building. It also shows areas of melted snow around sections of the reactor and changes in the appearance of the reactor. James Action, with the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, tells VOA's Victor Beatty it is another sign Pyongyang has no intention of denuclearizing.
It's another escalation by North Korea, another indication by North Korea that it really had no intention of denuclearizing. North Korea has already accumulated weapons-grade plutonium from that reactor. So it's a quantitative change rather than a qualitative change, but clearly it's a change in the wrong direction.
What is the status of this particular reactor?
This reactor was disabled during the Bush administration, and disabled meant putting it in such a state that it would take about a year to restart, which subsequently the North Koreans did. And then there were some various problems with the reactor, and it appears to have been shut down. Presumably then there was some kind of servicing, and it's now being restarted again. This is an old reactor.
The U.S. Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University said the latest satellite images showed fresh activity, suggesting early stages of an effort to restart the reactor. Signs that include steam coming from a probable pressure relief valve on a steam pipe just before it enters the turbine building, and meltwater running off the center of the turbine building roof. What does that tell you?
What they're describing there is the signs that you would expect to see of a reactor being started up. The heat from the turbines is melting snow on the roof. The steam is escaping as it starts to flow through the reactor circuit.
The North says that the purpose is to produce low-enriched uranium for a new reactor that it's constructing. Other experts suggest the real goal is weapons-grade uranium, an alternative to plutonium for a nuclear bomb. Where do you come down on that?
There are two different facilities here in question. One is the 5-megawatt reactor that we've just been discussing that's designed to produce plutonium, and I don't think even the North claims otherwise these days. Separately, there's an enrichment plant at this complex at Yongbyon, which has recently been expanded. And it's this plant was the one that you were just referring to there that the North claims is for the production of low-enriched uranium for a new reactor that it's building. I would say this much. We can't know what the purpose of that particular plant is. However, the purpose of the North's enrichment program as a whole, which is almost certainly at more than just one site, is at least in part to produce highly enriched uranium for weapons.
Earlier this month, the North offered to suspend its nuclear testing if the United States called off joint military exercises with South Korea this year, an offer rejected by Washington as inappropriate and an implicit threat. RAND Corporation Korea analyst Bruce Bennett believes restarting the plutonium reactor may be a tactic to pressure the U.S. to return to the negotiating table.
But in doing that, it's not trying to get negotiations to get North Korea to denuclearize. It's rather appears to be trying to get the United States and other countries to recognize North Korea as a nuclear power and thus a peer of the United States and Russia and the other nuclear powers. That's not an acceptable outcome from the perspective of the United States. So that's why the United States has been taking a strategic pause kind of approach with regard to North Korea. North Korea is not really serious about what should be the objectives of the negotiation.
The U.S., Japan, and South Korea held talks in Tokyo on Wednesday regarding North Korea, possibly resuming international negotiations. The top envoys to the six-party talks agreed to maintain sanctions against the communist North while keeping the door open to Pyongyang for bilateral dialogue on denuclearization. How likely is that?
Not very likely, I think. If you look at public opinion polls in South Korea, for example, 90% of the people respond that they don't expect North Korea to get rid of its nuclear weapons. There's not a lot of hope for that, but the United States has said, look, North Korea, If you want to get serious and demonstrate a willingness to get rid of your nuclear weapons, we're ready to go back to the negotiating table at any time. But if you don't do that, why would we want to negotiate with you? You look like you have different objectives.
The United States has called on Pyongyang to adhere to existing UN resolutions that prohibit its nuclear testing, cease all threats, reduce tensions, and take the necessary steps to denuclearize. The U.S. envoy on North Korean policy, Song Kim, told the U.S. Congress earlier this month that the North does not have to denuclearize before returning to the negotiating table, but it must demonstrate an early commitment to do so. The death of Saudi Arabia's king, the collapse of a U.S.-friendly government in Yemen, and a problematic relationship with Israel's leadership are presenting a new set of complications for the Obama administration and its Middle East policy. Not only is the U.S. leader dealing with adversaries in Iran, the Islamic State, and al-Qaeda, but he is now juggling trouble with traditional allies. White House correspondent Luis Ramirez has this report for VOA Television.
President Obama had a prickly relationship with the late Saudi King Abdullah, but paying his respect to successor King Salman this week marked a fresh start. Leading a high-level delegation, Mr. Obama traveled to Saudi Arabia at a time when the U.S. is most depending on the kingdom as an island of stability. The Middle East has suddenly become even more complex with the collapse of Yemen's government and the fight against Islamic State militants and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The challenge is a reason for the Obama administration to strengthen its ties to the Saudis, who have joined the U.S. in efforts to fight the Islamic State group and AQAP. Before cutting short a visit to India to head to Saudi Arabia, President Obama again ruled out any major deployment of U.S. troops in the Middle East.
Our efforts to go after terrorist networks inside of Yemen without a occupying U.S. army, but rather by partnering and intelligence sharing with that local government, is the approach that we're going to need to take. And that continues to be the case. The alternative would be for us to play whack-a-mole every time there is a terrorist actor inside of any given country to deploy U.S. troops. And that's not a sustainable strategy.
Finding a sustainable strategy in a quickly changing landscape is turning out to be a challenge for the Obama administration, says analyst Michael O'Hanlon.
I think part of what they're trying to do is just hold on. You know, it's an ugly time in terms of events and many relationships. And I don't think there's any plausible grand vision that's pointing in a happier direction, even if it works out as theoretically projected.
And then there is the complex relationship with the closest U.S. ally in the region, Israel, which, like Saudi Arabia, opposes Mr. Obama's efforts to engage Iran in nuclear negotiations and any U.S. moves that could be seen as strengthening Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu, as Israel's prime minister, has always been a guest at the White House, but won't be when he visits in March. U.S. lawmakers invited him to Washington without first consulting President Obama, and the U.S. leader has decided not to meet with him. Former State Department advisor Aaron David Miller says that while political and personal relations are troubled, the relationship as a whole is too big to fail.
I don't think, frankly, overall, this is going to affect in any, you know, galactic way the nature of the relationship.
Adding to the tensions in the region, Iran-backed Hezbollah claimed responsibility for this missile attack, the aftermath caught on amateur video, on an Israeli convoy at the Israel-Lebanon border Wednesday. Israel responded with airstrikes and artillery fire, raising concerns that missteps by either side could cause yet another conflict to escalate and a potential new headache for the U.S. administration. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Terrorism often has roots in failed states, according to terrorism expert Max Abrams of Northeastern University. We asked him why he believes this to be true.
There are two main explanations for why people become terrorists or why terrorism will take root in one place versus another. And the dichotomy that's set up is often between opportunity versus grievance. Opportunity refers to a condition in which terrorists might take advantage of a situation to aggrandize themselves, to achieve their political aims, to promote their cause, to infect the region and generate more terrorists. Versus grievance refers to, political frustration or annoyance, which might induce somebody to become a terrorist. In general, I think that failed states are so closely correlated with terrorism primarily because it creates opportunity rather than grievance, although the two are not completely distinct, of course. A good example is in Libya, which, you know, since removing Gaddafi, has been a failed state. And so there's a power vacuum there, and thus it's no surprise that Islamic State would try to metastasize into that area. You know, it's interesting because under the Bush administration, the received lesson was that foreign occupations breed terrorism. And so Obama really campaigned on reducing, on alleviating these foreign occupations in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. However, the lesson under his watch is that, yes, it might be true that foreign occupations breed terrorism, but so too do the opposite structural conditions. That is, when a military leaves or when a government is toppled, creating a power vacuum. And so much of the terrorism that we're seeing today is taking place in these kinds of power vacuums, which frankly, unbelievably, have only gotten worse already in 2015. In 2015, we've seen power vacuums become even worse in a number of terrorist hotspots, including Nigeria, Yemen, Syria, and Libya. And so I'm afraid that we're going to see even more international terrorism now that the terrorists have this unprecedented opportunity, given the anarchical nature of these countries with their weak government.
Max Abrams of Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts, who is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Friday, we'll ask what can be done to stop the growth of terrorism in these failed nations. The World Bank says the three countries most affected by Ebola will suffer a combined $1.6 billion in economic losses in 2015 due to the ongoing outbreak. Unemployment rates are also expected to remain high, with cross-border traders, private sector wage earners, and the self-employed among the worst hit. Jennifer Luzuta has details from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
The World Bank says that despite the recent slowdown in the number of new Ebola cases, the outbreak continues to cripple the economies in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. More than $500 million was lost due to foregone income in the three countries in 2014. It says that number is expected to more than triple in 2015. The World Bank says that Sierra Leone will be the worst hit, with $920 million in losses this year, followed by $540 million in Guinea and $180 million for Liberia. David Evans is a World Bank senior economist for the Africa region.
The economic impact on these three countries has been nothing short of catastrophic, really. Liberia's growth forecast for 2015 has been cut in half, and projected growth in Sierra Leone and Guinea for 2015 has shrunk to below zero. These are both countries that had healthy growth rates predicted for 2015 before the epidemic. So this is just a massive negative economic impact.
Evans said that reductions in business activity, trade, and planned foreign investment all contributed to the lower growth rates. The World Bank's Evans said the key now is to finally stop the outbreak.
The number one thing, ultimately, is getting to zero cases. Until we get to zero cases in these countries, people aren't going to feel completely confident going about their business and moving around and doing what they need to do to provide for their livelihoods.
He said it is difficult to say exactly how long a full recovery will take. but that these economies could bounce back relatively swiftly once the outbreak is truly under control. Jennifer Legitta for VOA News, Dakar.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events at our website, voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 26, 1564, the Pope issued a bull or charter confirming decisions made by the Council of Trent, which clarified Roman Catholic doctrine and condemned Protestantism. On this day in 1788, British Captain Arthur Phillip, commanding a fleet of 11 ships carrying some 700 convicts, established the first European settlement in New South Wales. The anniversary is a national holiday in Australia. In 1880, American General Douglas MacArthur was born. MacArthur fought in three major wars and rose to the rank of five-star general in the U.S. Army. He oversaw the surrender of Japan at the end of World War II and presided over its occupation. He was relieved of his duties when he openly questioned President Truman's policies. In 1924, the city of Petrograd in the Soviet Union was renamed Leningrad after the founder of communism. In 1991, there was another change when the city reverted to its historic name, St. Petersburg. On this day in 1950, the Indian Constitution took effect, making India the most populous democracy in the world. In 1998, U.S. President Bill Clinton looked into a TV camera and denied having had sexual relations with former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. He later admitted that he had indeed had an affair with a young woman. Mr. Clinton eventually faced impeachment by Congress stemming from his relationship with Lewinsky. In 2004, Afghan President Hamid Karzai signed a new constitution for his country. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Warring factions in South Sudan have agreed in principle to end the conflict that has caused the deaths of thousands of South Sudanese citizens. Now is the time to put these words into action. The United States, together with its troika partners, the United Kingdom and Norway, calls on the parties to use the upcoming Intergovernmental Authority on Development Summit on January 29th to secure peace. In the face of the deplorable humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, there can be no excuse for further delay in negotiations or for continued violence. We commend the IGAD and its special envoys for their steadfast commitment to the peace process, and welcome the strong message from People's Republic of China Foreign Minister Wang Yi calling on the parties to make peace. We recognize the agreement signed January 21st in the northern Tanzanian city of Arusha, which constitutes a roadmap towards unifying and reconciling the three factions of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement. But we have been deeply disappointed in the continued unwillingness of the parties to make the compromises needed to achieve a viable peace agreement. Over the past 2 months, their statements have suggested they have distanced themselves from previous commitments, and violations of the cessation of hostilities agreement have continued. We call on the parties to recommit to negotiate with a spirit of urgency and compromise, refrain from all further military action immediately, and form a transitional government of national unity. Over a year after the beginning of the conflict, nearly 2 million South Sudanese have been displaced. Over 100,000 are under the direct protection of the UN mission in South Sudan, and the country remains at risk of a food security crisis. Along with other international donors, we will continue to stand with the people of South Sudan, who are needlessly suffering as a result of this conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.